So, hey, Robin, guess what?
What, Lucy?
It's our anniversary!
Oh my god, it is!
Yeah!
We knew it was our anniversary. We had to record this episode.
Not a surprise. We've been planning this for a while, but yay!
Yay! It's also like April 1st is Clamp Day, because it's various people's birthdays. So, we thought that even though it's kind of weird timing for releasing an episode for us, we had to have an episode for this week.
Yeah, like we say, you know, that we've been planning this for a while, and we have been, but we did not expect various things to have happened in the intervening time.
Yeah, like for history's sake, I think we should just explain that there is a global epidemic and everybody in our state is social distancing in order to try to, like, stop everybody from just getting sick and overloading hospitals with people who can't breathe, because that's terrible. And so we're trying to not get sick. So instead of being, I don't know, we had a plan, everybody. We were going we had a beautiful plan. I own the Clamp in Wonderland music video, which is the subject of this week's episode. I own it on VHS. I bought it in like 2007 when I went to Japan. I bought it from Book Off, and it is precious. But I don't have a VCR that works anymore, but Lucy does. And we're going to have a party in Lucy's basement with VHS tapes.
I in fact have the VHS player I had in high school or whatever. I have like my family's VHS tape player.
Yeah, see,
oh my god, VCR. VCR is the name of this device.
Yeah, mine died. Like, we used ours to death at some point, because I used to have a lot of VHS tapes that I carried.
Oh, yeah, they're all in my garage now.
Yeah. Mine or yours?
Yours. Because your VCR died, and so you gave me a bunch of VHS, or you were going to get rid of a bunch of VHS tapes, and I was like, I have a VCR.
I'm horrified because I've forgotten which ones those are, and I still have a ton in mine, too. So.
There's a lot of Slayers in there, I think.
I will believe that, and probably at least one Escaflowne box set.
Oh, yeah. I think possibly two, because I think I have both yours and our other friend Amy's. Anyway, God.
Elderly.
We were going to have this nice little party, all nostalgic and whatnot, and that couldn't happen.
No.
Yeah.
It couldn't.
Yeah, as we were saying, history's sake, it's like we're recording this on March 29th. About 3 weeks ago, it seemed like nothing much was going to change. About 2 weeks ago, it seemed like things were starting to go a little like, oh, we're all going to stay inside and be on, like, you know, be extra safe. And now it feels like all things are ending. So it's a weird time.
Well, I mean, I had those two, like, the last couple episodes we've recorded, we were talking about Emerald City a lot. And Emerald City did not happen, which is, of course, financially devastating for a lot of artists. And I don't just mean artists like me who sell in Artist Alley. I mean the comic artists whose profession this convention is celebrating. Some of their books got canceled. Publishing is in crisis. I'm really lucky my publisher for Second is not doing too many draconian things yet. Like, my project is fine. I've heard from my editor, my agent. You know, obviously my editors and agent like live in New York, which is a terrible, terrible place to be right now.
Yeah,
but they're okay. Like, they all have reported in saying that they're okay. They're all working from home. And I'm just, shout out to everybody at For Second who is doing their damnedest. It's a pretty incredibly nuts time to be alive. And yet we're going, so like, instead of being in Lucy's cozy basement, like, hanging out and watching anime like our childhood nerd selves, we are, like, high-tech recording everything apart. Using so many glowing screens and so many, like, cables and different microphones. And it feels really, really weird to not have Lucy in the room with me. So I can't, like, read her facial expressions and figure out when she's going to talk or not.
Yeah, it's different. And we don't, like, we've never recorded this way before. And this is good because we'd want to be able to do this so we can maybe eventually have guests and stuff and know how to do that.
Yeah.
But it's definitely, like, it was not quite the circumstances we planned to be learning how to do this in.
Yeah. And of course, we're really lucky because we're fine. Like, it's just inconveniencing our lives. And of course, like, no one is completely fine. Like, this is, the economic impacts of this are far reaching and absolutely, like, impossible to even completely predict at this point.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, like, we're healthy. Lucy's roommate actually works for a retirement community, like works with the elderly. So we especially need to keep Lucy's house like free of people bringing in germs in order to try to help protect the really vulnerable people that her roommate is in contact with. So like we're really lucky. We're doing our best and we're going to try to keep up things like this so that there's something kind of normal going on.
Yeah. And I mean, it was kind of weird because we'd had like pre-record. Of course, this was the time we pre-recorded like 2 episodes a month ahead of time. And what could go wrong?
Right.
But yeah, we decided to just kind of keep those going. So, you know, because that ex conversation still needed to keep happening. And
yeah, it feels so relevant right now.
Right? Yeah, it's great. Everything's fine. But yeah, we are both extremely lucky in that we haven't been too impacted by all this. I mean, since I'm a student and we live in an era of technology, like my classes are just going to be all remote next term. Probably the entire term, but at least for the first couple of weeks, which is looking like longer and longer now.
Yeah.
But yeah, so not much has actually changed aside from, I don't know, our availability to go hang out with each other and stuff. But like, we're not impacted nearly as much as some people are who have lost their jobs or, you know, are sick themselves or dealing with sick family members and or overworked, you know, in the jobs that are still
on the front lines.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know for me, there's just this bit of like, the background stress is so intense that I have way more gray hair than I did a month ago. Like, literally have more gray hair, and I feel just like this intense background stress. So investing in projects is really helpful. Like, I have a tendency to overwork when I'm stressed instead of just
too,
shutting
probably.
Down and not working. Yeah, no, I think so. And I think, like, speaking of overwork and being stressed, but also, more importantly, trying to do things and keep some sort of sense of normalcy while everything is really weird. I'm not sure I want to say the word normalcy a lot, but it's just coming out. We are going to launch a Patreon.
Yeah.
And part of that is just that we have extra projects we want to do, and we figure this is going to be a way to organize them and get them into people's hands. We have a bonus episode that we're going to be working on, and then we have a side project.
Yes, we're excited about it.
Very, very much a let's keep busy kind of side project. Mm-hmm. So we're going to put up these extra episodes throughout the month, and there'll be a taste of what patrons on Patreon can get a hold of.
Mm-hmm.
We're really excited about doing things like that, but also, like, this is a rough time, and that's why we're trying to, like, give at least the first episodes away for free, is, like, just everyone needs stuff to do, and so we want to give you guys something to do.
Yeah, and us something to do.
Exactly. So there's no huge reason to need to immediately jump on and give us your extremely small amount of money that everyone is making right now. It's just that we wanted to build this for the future. Like, focusing on the future is a thing that I think I have to do so that I don't just lose it. Is I have to keep, like, I mean, I have a book cover due on Monday, so it will be done by the time you guys hear this. It will be done.
Oh, God. That's close. Ugh.
It's scary, dude. It's scary. It's open on the glowing screen to my left, as opposed
ominous.
To the two glowing screens in front of me. It's just open, looking at me, saying, there's so many more leaves you need to color in, Robin. Oh, and then, like, the first pass of, like, the finished book is due on the 15th, and hopefully the whole book will be done by... I'm hoping it'll be done by the end of April. It'll probably be sometime in May, because that's just sort of how the world goes. It's how publishing goes. But, like, just trying to keep busy and work on these projects. And I think just anything that we can all do to plan for the future and keep working on the things that matter to you.
Yeah.
Keep in sight that you're doing things for a tomorrow that will exist, because you just got to get outside of that apocalyptic mindset. I think that's also why we're doing this episode, is that speaking of getting outside of an apocalyptic mindset, we need to, like, have a break from X before we go right back. And again, we're going to take a break in the middle of X to go do Magic Knight Rayearth for a while, because we just need those breaks. It is a rough place to be.
Yeah.
Emotionally all the time, worrying about the future and worrying about the present. And it's like, if you can take that worry and turn it into planning, it is a little bit less overwhelming, even though it's still, it could be problematic to also just be that overworked all the time. But we're going to do our best to not overwork ourselves. This mystery project, it's not a mystery, like this side project Do you want to talk a little bit about it, Lucy?
Yeah. And I will add just what you said. It's nice to remember that even though, you know, things may turn out on the other side of this very different from what they were before, that planning towards the future and remembering that this is just like a period in time is definitely one of the things kind of I find helpful. But yeah, our little kind of like extra project we're doing is we both are kind of committed to trying to write a book this year in 2020. And we decided to kind of chronicle that process, like check in kind of like as a way to keep ourselves on task, I guess.
And
a little bit of a support group buddies.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, we're not quite sure how often we're going to do either of the bonus episodes, but pretty frequent for this one where we'll kind of just do a quick little short check-in about where our projects are and, you know, how kind of help each other through whatever, you know, writer's block or whatever it is we're facing. And yeah, and kind of just bring people along for kind of what the process looks like. And then ideally kind of like wrap that into once we start querying and stuff, ideally, we can kind of like show people what that process is, because it kind of gets kind of mysterious, especially if you're like a very new writer or not at all into the writing world. You kind of don't know a lot of how it goes, and we're positioned where we can kind of help with that.
It's a very obfuscated industry, some of which is kind of on purpose, some of which is really not on purpose at all. But I also think that when you hear people tell their story after the fact about how a book got published, when they say things like, and then I waited 2 years, that doesn't mean anything. But if you're along for the ride, waiting with somebody and hearing their thought process as they're waiting to hear back from a query or just getting through how hard it actually is to write, to me, it feels like something that might be helpful for people who want to be in that world, but maybe even helpful for people who are just interested in that process as a reader, right? Like, man, remembering how much human labor goes into these things. I think it can help you respect your fellow humans who make work and help you kind of understand what you're reading a little bit better, too. If you're like, wow, this thing feels like it's 10 years old, maybe because it actually took 10 years to get done, right? Like, there are times where you might learn interesting things just knowing how not fast-paced every part of the entertainment industry actually is. Mm-hmm. Like, a year just feels like nothing to me. Like, it's so fast, right? Because I'm just like, oh, you need a couple of those for each project. And it's a weird way to measure your time and measure your life is, like, by project. I think that it would be really good for us for accountability, but also maybe interesting for other people to learn a little bit in real time about what that process is. And also, I just really, really do intend to write a novel this year. And I think when we say, like, oh, we're writing a book, we should clarify we're both going to write novels and separate novels. We're not writing a novel together. Yeah. Like, 'cause I've written a book. Like, it's the one I'm working on right now, but it's a graphic novel. And I have so many picture book manuscripts I'm also going to be working on, but none of those count for this podcast, although I'll probably talk about them anyway, because they're, like, my life. But I want to write a novel, and I've been writing the same novel for a long time, and I think that I need to, like, deal with all of my guilt and weird feelings I have about that, so...
Yeah, and I'm not sure what I'm going to be working on yet, but well, you know what? We'll hammer that out in the first episode of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's kind of it's us just working on projects, trying to get them done, like well, specific projects, and trying to get them done in you know a reasonable amount of time so that we can, but not like published. Like it's not going to be like we're going to have a book out on shelves in a year. It's we're going to have a manuscript that we could start editing and taking to people in a year, which is not undoable.
No, totally possible. I mean, we've both, like, finished Nano before.
Oh, yeah.
And we've that both, is not like, the same thing as writing a book, but it is very similar. And if in 1 month we can do it, I'm like, yeah, if we give ourselves the rest of the year, like, I've done it before. We can do it.
Yeah, we've both written book-length things before. We just, you know, and I mean, you obviously have a book coming out, so it's not, we're not quite completely newbies at this, but it's, you know, it's chronicling this specific like project through and like I've only had like a short story published, so for me it is very much like a I would like to change that type thing.
Yes, and I am really excited to help make that happen whatever way I can.
It's gonna be fun. We'll probably spend the first episode of that just kind of trying to figure out what it's gonna be, so look forward to that at some point this month. And then if you know subscribe to the Patreon, you will also get the next episodes of that as they exist.
Yeah, and we haven't decided, well, Lucy may sort of know exactly what we want the bonus episode to be. We have a couple ideas that we're, like, really raring to do, and it will be interesting to do all of these things remotely, but you guys should get excited, because whatever it's going to be something we are going to be very passionate about.
Yeah.
Because every one of the ideas we have is something we love so much that it hurts.
Yeah, the idea for that, it's not very mysterious either, is we just wanted a place where we could talk about things we love besides Clamp, but in a kind of similar way, and kind of like a similar era of our lives, like, so other anime probably, primarily, if not entirely. So, yeah, if you like things kind of like Clamp, you will probably like the things we're talking about, and it won't be like this where we're doing, you know, a whole artist's work, or, you know, a whole like mini episodes on one thing, volume by volume. It'll be a little bit more holistic, but yeah, it should be fun. I'm looking forward to an excuse to just talk about other things we love.
Yeah, it'll help like contextualize everything and put it all together. Yeah. I'm all about finding those patterns.
Yeah, because especially anime of a similar era, like there's a lot of, you know, influence both directions from Clamp and from other things. So it'll be interesting, and I'm sure we will discuss that as part of it.
Yeah. All right, so let's get this episode underway.
Yeah, let's do it.
So this is about the Clamp in Wonderland music video. We are jumping ahead to 1994, but we decided we were allowed to because it's our anniversary and we can do what we want.
Yep, it was too perfect not to. Like, it
really was.
It's our like namesake. We had to do it.
Yes. Clamp in Wonderland is a music video that was released on VHS as an OVA, which is a original video animation, in 1994. My VHS tape says it cost 3,200 yen, so like $30, which is nuts, but that is the Japanese, like, media market. Every video is like $30 or $40, and they have like one or two episodes on them. It's nuts. It's a little better now, but not much better. I remember CDs being like $40 and just being like, this is unbelievable. But that's what it is. It is about, because like, this is like 7 minutes of animation for $30.
Yeah, that is crazy to me, but I do know that Japan tends to have a kind of a very expensive media market.
Yeah. And also, there's a little element of like, because it's so direct from the animation studio, the price kind of like reflects how precious it is in a way that American stuff like does not. It really obfuscates the labor involved and the value of things. So there's that. I think my VHS tape was a retired rental.
Aww.
I bought it, as I said, from Book Off in like 2007, and it's precious to me. So Clamp in Wonderland has two parts, kind of like an opening and an ending theme song. The first part runs for about 4 minutes. The second part runs for about three. The first part is a lively animated sequence of all of Clamp's characters set to Anatadake no Wonderland, usually translated as Your Very Own Wonderland. Our theme song, by the way, is a riff from that song that I adapted on the harp. So I'm sure that many listeners noticed that. But if you didn't know, that's what it is I learned to play the song on the harp and just kept a little piece of it for our opening. The ending theme is a really sweet song and a much more limited sequence. And the song is Anata ga shiawase de aru yoni, translated as I want you to be happy. Both songs were written by Nanase Okawa, very specifically referencing the action and emotions of the sequences. And the music was by Seiko Nagaoka, sung by Junko Hirotani. It was produced by Animate, who I assumed paid for and distributed this, which is for some reason really hard info for me to find. I don't know why.
Yeah, this was very hard for us to research. Mostly you. You did most of the research.
I've been tearing my hair out over it. I can find like everyone who worked on it and all this information about the production and no information about who funded it and how you would buy it. But I'm pretty sure that because Animate is a big distributor, probably was like in their stores or in the sections that they bought out of other stores that would distribute anime and things like that. As we have mentioned before about OVAs and OAVs, same thing. They had a lot to do with the direct video rental market, just like direct-to-video stuff in America was like, it was just this huge thing, like pre-Netflix, video rental stores were this innovation in the 80s that just absolutely changed entertainment. So having things for people to rent was like a big deal. And that was a market, like someone might put money out to do a project like this just because they knew they would make money off of rental sales, which is again nuts for me to even imagine. This thing must have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars. I don't think $1 million. I don't think $1 million because it's really 7 minutes and it's not that like that crazy, but a lot, maybe. Animation studios just paying for their time to work on something is such an incredible feat to be able to even get your foot in the door. And some of this is, you know, as I'm about to explain, this was animated by Madhouse kind of before they were Madhouse, right? Like, this was really early for them. They're now, of course, one of the most established anime studios, but this was still kind of early in their era. I have heard the videos distributed with their Clamp in Wonderland, like, periodical, but I can't find info to back that up either. And that would make a lot of sense to me, right? If this was, like, bundled in with a book, so whoever was publishing or producing or packaging the book might have put the money up for this as, like, a huge promo thing.
Yeah.
But I can't find that info. So if anybody has that, goodness tell me, this is my best guess.
Yeah, we couldn't find any sources for that, but yeah, so if you know information about that and can source it, please let us know.
Give it to me. Clamp were very involved in the pre-production. They wrote out storyboards, like, this was something they were really involved in, and the art director was Kumiko Takahashi, who we heard about before. She did the character designs for the Tokyo Babylon OVA.
I think you can tell, like, it looks, I don't know, I love the way this of the all the animated things they've done, I love this one the most, and
me too.
Like, visually, and I think you can tell that they, like, because the Tokyo Babylon OVA had, like, a similar, I don't know, art style to it.
There's a feel that just, like, it's not exactly Clamp art. It doesn't look like their comic but moving, but it spiritually feels a lot like it. I feel like some of it is that the blacks are black instead of just kind of as grayed out. Like, there's something about the color quality that just kind of reminds me of manga more.
Yeah.
The watercoloriness.
Yeah, and I feel like this is about the closest to their art that anything ever gets. Which is not a dig to others, but I just think that this maintains that style as close as possible of the things that have come out, and I love that.
Yeah, I think so too. So Lucy, talk to us about what happens in this little sequence.
So this, I have to first say, every time I watch this on YouTube in, like, you know, actual quality, I just am almost crying, because I originally, like, downloaded this from the internet into sketchy files and watched it all pixelated on my, like, you know, TV, or not TV, and on my computer in, like, 99 or whatever, 2001, something like that. And this and, like, the Clover music video, I just, like, had, you know, in horrible quality that was impossible to see. But, yeah, so it kind of opens with Kamui walking down the street, and the little pufferfish logo that is the logo for the Clamp school and that Clamp themselves kind of used a lot at this time just sort of, like, hops by him as, like, an actual physical pufferfish, not just, like, a emblem. And he kind of chases it and falls into this void that, you know, is assumably Wonderland. And then we kind of just get these different shots of all of our beloved characters. There's kind of, like, a quick flyby of all of them, like, in quick succession, and then it kind of goes on to kind of give us these cinematic moments for each series, and they're really just so lovely and so fun. Like, you can tell people had a lot of fun making them really entertaining. We start with sort of, like, a scene of the Reg Veda crew attacking the castle, kind of like what happens at the end, but they kind of bust in just to find Ashiro, Taishakuten, Shashi and Kendappa just playing a board game, and just they kind of look up like, what's up?
I thought it was Shoji, but it might be Go. I can't remember.
I don't think it's Go. It looked, but I don't really know much about.
It's really cute.
It's
such
really
a cute,
cute
sequence.
And also, when I was little, when I was in high school or whatever, watching this, it was so pixely that I couldn't really tell who any of those people were.
Yeah.
I just know that they, like, came upon someone and then had, like, a pratfall from it. But yeah, so I'm so delighted that I can make out those characters now.
It's a beautiful thing.
And we kind of have a note here that Ryo's hair color is, I guess, accurate here or whatever. A few different characters in this have, like, what I consider to be their, like, canon hair colors, and they kind of differ from some of the other anime representations.
Yeah.
And he's kind of the first one.
Looks so much more sourced from their color artwork, because of course it is sourced from their color artwork.
Yes, and they had a lot to do with it. So then we get to see a little clip of the cherry blossom scene from Tokyo Babylon, except just as it's kind of getting dramatic, Hokuto interrupts it by just smashing Seishiro with a very 90s anime mallet,
yes.
Not mullet.
Yes.
And it's just very satisfying and cutesy.
It is.
Yeah.
And very 90s. It's
very
also 90s. The second time this sequence has been animated for those keeping score.
Yes, indeed.
Second of Well, there are still more after this.
Yeah, it's not the second and not the last.
Yes.
And now it kind of transitions over to Tokyo Tower, and we can see all the seven seals and seven angels hanging out, being ominous in their billy cloaks, including one of them who is not revealed because we hadn't met that character yet, and we haven't gotten to them in the manga, so
yeah,
why dwell on it?
It's perfect timing.
It's perfect timing.
It is also our first shot of grown-up dead inside Subaru and the dead-eyed Seishiro.
That's true.
That we see animated.
Oh, I forgot I forgot that. That's a good... I mean, I didn't forget that they were there, but I forgot the significance of this moment, Rob.
I know. It's the first time that we've seen the two of them, like, and for the podcast, the first time that they've both been present on screen in anything. So,
yeah.
Very exciting. Oh,
God. Anyway.
Exciting in a sad way, but that's life right now. It's exciting
in
a sad way.
I can't wait to get back to them in X, Robin. I need it so bad. Anyway, this dramatic scene is kind of interrupted by, like, the tower getting electrocuted and the ray earth mechs literally just like bursting out of the ground and destroying everything, and then Wilkona's kind of bopping around, and so in an attempt to not trip on her, the mechs all kind of like fall over, and each of the ray earth girls gets caught by the Clamp Campus detectives, who then individually get swooshed away to their own little series. Like Utako grabs Akira, and he, you know, changes into being 20 masks. Andy kind of runs off with Nokoru to do Dukleon things. Suo has kind of like a sweet little moment with Nagisa, who has blonde hair in this, not light purple, like she did in the manga. I mean, like she did in the anime. Keep track here. And it Hikaru had pink hair instead of red, we're keeping our hair count going.
We are definitely keeping our hair count going.
And then we get like a little scene of the Dukleon boys, including like the full cast, not just like Nokoru. And it's very, I want my Dukleon anime.
Yeah. I know.
And you have a cute scene with Shinohime kind of blows through looking all majestic, and she's being kind of run after by Shang Huang and Meng Yong on his tiger. And using magic, and it's very much one of those, oh, it might have been. And then we have a quick little scene of Miyuki running off with some sexy ladies following her. And then it turns into the thing that haunted me for years, Robin, years.
Yes.
Wondering who this character was. It's a strange, boy with, like, another little boy on his back, and then they kind of... You know, the camera kind of swings around, and now it's a adult man with a very mysterious hat that might be his hair. And now it is not a mystery, but for years, this drove me crazy.
And we will circle around back to this.
Yes. Yes,
we will. Half the episode will be circling around back to this.
Mm-hmm.
But talk to us about how this first sequence ends, Lizzie.
Yeah, so it kind of just concludes with... It says the end or end, and it pulls out, and you can sort of see that we've been in a theater, and the camera's kind of at the back, and so all the people start standing up, and it's the various characters from behind, and it's very kind of tear-jerking moment as you're like, oh, all my people I love. And yeah, as I was watching it this time, it kind of reminded how we've been talking about how Clamp uses the kind of like characters as actors thing, where they'll sort of cast various archetypes, I guess, in their different series.
Yeah. The idea that these characters got to watch themselves and are really excited to see themselves animated, It even comes up in some of their work, right? Like in Dukleon, they were watching things and being all upset about it. And we haven't gotten to Miyuki-chan in Wonderland yet, but it happens in Miyuki-chan also. Like, they just kind of talk about this a lot. It's something that they like to reference, is the idea of characters having like this very meta interaction with their own properties.
Mm-hmm.
So after this really action-packed, like, I don't know, like, this whole first sequence just makes me so happy. It gets me so revved up. And then there's this little second sequence, which is mostly a credits scene. It's really sweet, though. It's also a really lovely song, and it references the Princess Mokona storybook thing, which I think actually came out after the music video in December of 1994. It's a 10-page picture book style mini comic about an egotistical princess named Mokona being taught a lesson in goodness from the people, including the Clamp School detectives. And we may do an episode on it later, since I have it.
Aww.
It was reprinted in the Clamp Northside art book. I don't have a copy of it published on its own. The song is sweet, reminding the listener that even if it rains in your heart, remember that I'll always be with you, wishing for your happiness.
Aww.
It's a really sweet thing for an author to write. The character, who is Princess Mokona, in rain gear, walks through a light rain at a slow and steady pace, even though she's passed by the other clamp members in their own little animal suits with umbrellas. Mick is a hyper puppy girl, Satsuki is a somber bear, and Okawa is a hopping pink bunny. At the end, the rain clears, she puts away her umbrella, bows, and walks off. The video ends with a promise. See you again. And they will, because there is a second Clamp in Wonderland music video that we will not talk about for probably years.
Yes.
But they did another one that was their post-1994. I think 1994 to, like, something in the 2000s, 2006, 2007.
Six, yeah.
Yeah. So we loved this as kids. This was something, you know, especially because when we were kids, as we've mentioned many times, we didn't have access to all of their works. So it was just really, it was tantalizing. Like, who was Jirahime? Who was Chun Hwang, right? Like, who were these characters? But the biggest mystery that we never had solved, which of course is not a big mystery to their OG fans, right? Their OG fans knew everything about this. But for all of us newcomers from overseas in the 90s, who was this boy with the hat hair and the green baby? Like, what's all this green boy? And I remember that we used to, like, shriek over this. Like, they used to drive us crazy because we just could not find this info. And of course, years later, I became a really big JoJo fan. So the answer is, he is a JoJo. He is a Clamp JoJo. He is Clamp's JoJo OC. The best, I mean, like, our document for this has a section called Buckle Up for JoJo Time. So everybody, buckle up for JoJo Time.
Yeah, I'm very excited. I think I remember when you got into JoJo and told me this, I probably screamed at you. Because
yeah,
I was like, what?
We've been wondering for years.
Yeah, which is interesting because I think JoJo people have, like, the same thing in reverse, but we'll get to it. We'll get to it. Sorry.
Yes, yes. And I think I'm not going to give you guys the biggest, like, what is JoJo explanation, but I would give you a little bit of one because I think it's kind of interesting and important to know, like, how any of these things would be interrelated. In Clamp in Wonderland Summer 1994, a fan extravaganza that had taken over for their old doujin mags and Clamp Lab, they now infamously published a JoJo Part 3 doujinshi. They were huge JoJo's Bizarre Adventure fans, especially fans of Part 3, which is Stardust Crusaders. They were such big fans that they infamously stuffed the ballots of Puff Magazine's character polls to make sure Jotaro won, even though they were probably the only ones voting for him.
Oh, is he the one with the hat?
He is the one with the hat. Okay. He is the main character.
So I'll try and ask you stupid questions throughout this to keep up.
Yes. And it is just called, like, JoJo to most people because JoJo's Bizarre Adventures, JoJo no Kimio na Boken, is a little long to just get out of your face all the time. We're on part 8 right now. It's not done yet. It has been published since, oh my goodness, since 1987, which is an interesting year, since that is also pretty early in Clamp's career.
Yeah.
They had nothing to do with each other in particular. Hirohiko Araki has his own crazy story about how he became a mangaka and the weirdness that JoJo's Bizarre Adventure has been. It has gone through permutations over the years. Each of the parts are so different from each other that they're kind of, like, almost their own thing. But Stardust Crusaders was, it was his really big hit. It broke out like crazy. It ran in Shonen Jump, which is, of course, like, the premier most read comic magazine in Japan and really the world. And it ran from 87 to 1992. So it had completed by 1994. Absolutely completed. And it also ends in a bloodbath and kills a whole bunch of the main cast. But we'll get back to that. What is Part 3? What is Stardust Crusaders? It follows Beefcake, Joseph Joestar, and his grandson, Jotaro Kujo, who's also a beefcake, as they trek around the world trying to track down the Joestar's ancestral villain, the master-manipulating super-sexy vampire Dio, who is based in Egypt and sending tarot-themed goons at them. Also, everyone has superpowers that come from having a kind of spiritual avatar-slash-imaginary friend called a stand. This series, it was a huge deal, which is really weird, because it is unique-looking, he has psychedelic colors. Everybody is in these tortured supermodel poses and Tom of Finland-style muscle physiques. It's just something you could never imagine this would be as big as it is. And I'm so glad that it is. It's just nuts. The important thing to know is that Jotaro Kujo, the one with the black coat that's an altered school uniform jacket and the weird hat morphing into hair situation, and Noriaki Kakuin, the one in a green schoolboy outfit that is altered beyond belief, and asymmetrical red hair and cherry earrings, are the two high school boys, high school giant beefcakes boys, I guess, who are ostensibly best friends, but apologies to Araki-sensei, don't really interact that much, but they have been shipped for decades at this point. Obviously, especially by Clamp.
Hmm.
So I need to, at this point, tell you that there is a spoiler alert for something from 1992. Kakuin dies at the end of part three. He dies fairly horribly, and it was, like, really, really shocking, and definitely, definitely an influence on Clamp and everybody else. I don't think people were expecting him to die. It's maybe not as influential as the deaths at the end of Devilman, but it is not entirely dissimilar to that in some ways, and I can see how this would work in the primordial ooze of all of these wonderful creators, like, developmental brain. They definitely decided that he didn't die for this multi-part Jijichi. Like, they reset all of that, which is nice, because I love everyone who died in part three, and it's really sad that they died. I always describe Kakuin as being my default favorite character, because he's sort of sad. He's weird and sad, so I like him. But I really think Polnareff is actually my favorite. He's the one with the giant silver flat top. He's the one who looks at toilet. He's great. I fucking love him. So, this little doujinshi series that they did is called JoJo's Bizarre Married Life. It starts out with this little chapter about Jotaro kind of strong-arming Kakuin into signing marriage papers while they're still in high school, and Kakuin not having any traditional wife skills, and being bad at cooking, and kind of defeating Dio with that, or at least Jotaro eats the bad cooking and beats Dio at eating breakfast, I guess.
It was pretty epic.
And then there's a one-shot about everyone spying on them on their wedding night fucking using Grandpa Joseph Joestar's stand power, Hermit Purple. I need to tell you that JoJo has, like, no sex in it somehow. Like, it sometimes has sexual harassment because Shonen Jump is really bad about teaching little boys how to not be sexual harassers. It has a little bit of that. And everybody is very sexual, but, like, they don't do anything with anybody else. Like, it really takes a long time. Like, other than Joseph Joestar being a massive slut, I mean, half of the cast are, like, his children, and they're all related in really upsetting ways because his man-slutting around really, really messes with genealogy. But, like, but it's not on screen. Like, for something as, like, weirdly sexual as the art makes it seem, it just, like, doesn't happen on screen. It doesn't happen on screen in this doujinshi either. They mostly just react as though, like, I don't know what they were expecting to look at, but they, like, kind of freak out about it. They use Grandpa Joseph Joestar's stand power, Herbert Purple, which is a remote camera thing that's also purple. Vines, I don't know. Anyway.
I'm sorry, I just, like, Herbert Purple is the dumbest name or something. Like, what?
Look, all of their names were tarot cards plus a color.
Oh.
Shut up.
Well, what's the excuse for the world? It doesn't have a color.
It's I'll stop the world and melt with you, Lucy.
Oh, it's getting into song lyrics. Okay.
Yeah,
songs.
Eventually everybody gets named after songs. The world is also a tarot card, though.
I know, but it doesn't have a color. That was my point.
No, because it's very important and big.
Got
anyway,
it. Okay.
Anyway, so that one ends with Kakuin being, like, really embarrassed and done with this and saying he's just going to go to his own house for a while, which, like, fair, babe, fair. Like, God. I don't know. That one is nothing. But then there's the egg baby saga, and that is what we're talking about here. So one morning, there is a very large egg in Kakuin's bed. Polnareff, who, again, is the one with the giant silver flat top, is infamously demands, Kakuin, did you lay this egg? And Kakuin, by the way, does not think he laid this egg. Like, he's pretty clear that he's like, I have no idea where this came from. Like, he does not think he passed an egg in the night. Like, he doesn't. He has been recast into kind of a sweet retiring nerd. Think Yukito from Cardcaptor Sakura. Boy, I said Yukito like burrito.
Oh, God. So, what is he normally?
Lucy, you don't understand. Araki doesn't really write characters, so he's nothing. Kakuin's personality is, well, he's cool and doesn't talk very much, which is Jotaro's personality, but Jotaro is a little more, like, of a badass delinquent, and Kakuin is more of, like, kind of a creeper. I don't know. They don't really have personalities. They don't interact. They don't do anything. I love them. And I love Aniki and I love JoJo, but there is more characterization in this than there actually is in JoJo. And that is one of the magical things about Clamp and about fanfiction. Anyway, Kakyoin, everyone is really bewildered and very congratulatory. Joseph is really delighted. He's going to be a great grandpa. When the egg hatches, it is so obviously Jotaro's child that there is no longer a question as to whether this egg is proof of their loving union or not. I mean, he has the Joestar star birthmark on his shoulder and a bad attitude and everything. So because he has such a similar personality to Jotaro, such personality as he has, he immediately hates his dad. This is fair, as JoJo fans know, because Jotaro is an infamously terrible dad. Just ask Jolene from part 6. The entirety of part 6 is about him having to patch up his relationship with his delinquent daughter, and it's actually fucking wonderful.
Aww.
Set in a women's prison. It's disgusting and amazing, and I love it. And it ends by destroying everything, because he was really tired of having to deal with his editors and making JoJo. Anyway, so back to Egg Baby Saga. Kakyoin instantly bonds with the Egg Baby, who has some edible must protect mommy from daddy bullshit going on. They name him Jota Kuto. So he's Jota, so he's a JoJo too. He grows super fast, so they have to see him off to kindergarten, where he gets into fights and draws really good drawings of his terrible dad. Jotaro does not like how the drawing was labeled, and it almost comes to blows, which triggers Jota's stand. That's his superpower, like, homunculus avatar thing. It is also cute and fat and super deformed, and basically a clone of Jotaro's Star Platinum, but green, and kind of amorphous slash goopy, like Kakyoin's Hierophant Green. More proof that they fucked, and this is their baby. So, it gets named after dishwashing detergent, Charmy Green.
Which is very cute name. A very cute name, I must say. Yeah. Like,
I would probably buy that dishwashing detergent just for the name and now for the JoJo reference. Yeah.
Yeah.
The final chapter of Egg Baby Saga shows Jota grown up to Clamp Teendom, meaning his same age great uncle, because it's hard to explain how he's related to Josuke Higashigata, but Josuke is my favorite JoJo. It is just the meeting and Josuke hero-worshipping the situation because he's really impressed with Jotaro being a teen dad and being married to a man. His catchphrase, Gureito, takes up a lot of visual real estate here. It's very cute, completely bizarre, and like, guys, it's not JoJo. It is maybe more JoJo than anything Araki actually wrote himself. Every one of these characters has like even the ones I didn't even mention here, like Avdol is alive and he's really cool in this too, and actually really like kind of very much himself. Like, it's really silly the extent to which they kind of got these characters maybe actually better than Araki did. There is more characterization of these than in JoJo, even if it's weird and shippy. I kind of love this, and I think a lot of other JoJo fans might kind of love it too, if they can get over the whole M-Preg thing.
Which, I mean, I gotta say, was like the least weird thing and least confusing part of this doujin to me.
Yeah. I mean, they also did not make it very visceral. Like, they didn't do a lot with that. Like, this thing is not incredibly pornographic or anything. It's just playful, and they hand wave it. Like, they joke about hand waving this. They're like, yeah, it's possible, it's JoJo, everything's possible. Like, they make jokes like that and you're like, yeah, no, totally, it's JoJo, anything's possible. The things that happen in JoJo are so ridiculous that if you said this happened, someone would not be able to tell you it couldn't. Like, no one could deny that this is a completely feasible JoJo thing that could definitely happen. The only reason that you wouldn't believe it is that these two characters, like, well, A, one of them is dead, which also wouldn't necessarily stop him from having an egg baby because it's JoJo. But, like, and I need to remind you that part of why that's not ridiculous is that Dio sort of has a son while he's dead, but it's actually also sort of Jonathan's son, even though Jonathan's dead, because Dio's head gets put on Jonathan, who is the OG JoJo from part one. Dio's head gets put on Jonathan's body, so the Dio that you see throughout parts 2 and 3, he's not really in part 2, but in part 3, and then you see him in the background of other things because there's flashbacks and stuff, he definitely is wearing Jonathan's body, so he fathers progeny, and all that progeny is definitely kind of really Jonathan's, not Dio's, but it's sort of infected by his horrible Dio-ness. So, you know, I'm just telling you, Egg Baby, not that weird for it's not that weird for JoJo. It's just not.
Yeah, I mean, they have weird psychic, like, people that come out of them. I think the egg thing is, like I said, when I read this, knowing very little about JoJo, that was, like, the least of my confusion. I was like, sure, he had an egg baby. What the hell is going on?
So, like, my favorite thing in the world is that this Doujinshi OC is in this music video, which was commercially distributed.
Yeah, it's so weird to me that this made it into their music video and not any of, like, their weird Sonic OCs or whatever. Like,
yes, I'm really sad there aren't a bunch of Sonic OCs in this, actually. Yeah. Like, it would make it even better. But this was a mystery for years. Like, we just straight up didn't know. And the funny thing is, like, if you had asked me, well, Robin, this has to be from a doujinshi. Like, this has to be fan art. This character is a fandom OC. What would it be? I probably could have told you it was JoJo, even a long time ago, because my siblings and I had there was a JoJo fighting game, which was the first JoJo thing that really made it to the US that I loved. It was really, really cool. And the characters were, like, stylish and fashionable and very queered up, which is pretty incidental to JoJo, but they are. Like, every JoJo is a queer icon, even though, like, none of them know they have sexuality at all, other than sometimes having children and sometimes cheating on their wives. And sometimes having, like, almost certainly boyfriends, it's complicated. But, like, this game was something that my little brothers and I, like, definitely played and were kind of into. So I knew about this. And then eventually, when I started to track this stuff down, I was like, oh no, I'm really into it. I'm immediately into this. And at some point, my brain started to, like, work. And I was like, oh no, that hat. Oh no. Charmy Green, like that character design, I've seen this before, and I was able to put it all together even before I did any research, because I was like, oh no, they were fans. So I just love that, like, something from their doujinshi souls has made it into their, like, most like canon specific to them, like self-indulgent things that they've put out there. Like, this thing is, it has their name right on it. It's just about their work, and there is a little kickback to their origins in fandom.
Yeah, it's just so delightful, especially because they kind of end that, you know, that half of the video with it, and yeah. It's just such a sweet little, like, nod to, you know, their fans, and especially the people that have been with them since their doujin days, and just, yeah, it's so lovely.
I really love it. I think that maybe before we just finish this off, we should mention that, of course, it has an Alice in Wonderland theme as well. Mm-hmm. And that is something they return to over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
We've already seen hints of it in Tokyo Babylon. There's a couple pieces that have kind of like an Alice in Wonderland feel to them, like a couple art pieces. There's one with like a caterpillar theme and Alice hanging out with the hookah-smoking caterpillar, but it's Hokuto and Seishiro and Subaru, right? So they've already started to touch on these things with White Rabbit imagery and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They use it an awful lot in Cardcaptor Sakura. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Miyuki-chan in Wonderland is just a sexy Alice in Wonderland retelling. And we'll get to that one pretty soon, too, I think.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
fun to see her in this. It's really fun to see her. Like, anytime they play with that character, we just love to see her. She was so embarrassing to us when we were, like, kids who were really nervous about sex and sexuality. And now that we're adults, we're just like, oh, Miyuki-chan, it's so good to see you, girl. It's really nice. But I love that this has that, like, I am such a lifelong Alice in Wonderland aficionado and addict. So it's another one of those, like, oh, no, I feel so bonded to this because of the Alice in Wonderland bits.
Yeah. It's one of those things that you see again and again. It's really nice. I don't know. When it's a thread weaving through a lot of their stuff. It's nice to see.
Yeah. And also something that, like, Lucy uses in her own, own online branding and everything.
Yeah. My blog is Lucy in Bookland.
Yeah. And I was just like, no, there's reasons that we are so fixated on this. Like, it's just in and out of Clamp, it has been something that matters to us a lot. Yeah, and I like that. I also think there's really something to be said about the almost like Disneyland kind of terminology there, too, of just understanding the idea that, like, oh, you can have an entire universe where all of your characters and worlds that you've built all sort of, like, get to exist. And I think We will talk about that a lot with Clamp stuff because obviously they have a shared universe in the works we're reading right now. The Clamp School stuff and X and Tokyo Babylon are all deeply interrelated, but it happens again later with them. And again, this is something that like groups of friends sitting around just trying to make stuff up. You know, amateur fiction writers will do this too. And whenever you see it in professional fiction, I love it. I don't know. It feels so much like my own experience of being a kid and being excited about coming up with characters and worlds, that when I see it done well, or even just done with passion, I'm just like, yes, my soul gets this. Like, I can resonate with it. Even if I don't love how it's done, I still like feel like you're definitely allowed to do this.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, that might be it for this episode, Robin. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we've talked a lot about it. I mean, just like everybody, it's really lovely. It is out on DVD. They're not super easy to get a hold of. I think that it came out, I'm going to say that the two of them, it came out as like a double set in probably 2007. But good old eBay might be able to help you out here. They're worth having. They're sweet. They're interesting. And they're definitely kind of a, I don't know, I wouldn't say they're a relic. Things like this still get made, but they would be made like as a promo thing for YouTube. And it's really interesting to think about these things being made at a time where like the distribution would have been selling VHS tapes, would be selling this like short music video, that a promotional thing that would also be sold or packaged with a book or something else like that. There are other Clamp animated things over the years and very recent ones that have been distributed as a bonus extra with magazines or books. So this is something that they keep doing. And I think it's a really wonderful promotional tool. I think it's a beautiful like relic to have of another era too. But projects that just like, you can't have the billions of dollars set aside to make an entire animated series, but we can have this tantalizing little glimpse that brings everything to life and sets it to music. If you want to read the lyrics to Anata Daka no Wonderland, it is adorably about what you're seeing. Like, it has a line that's like definitely about Subaru. Just oh, boy with sad eyes. Oh no, Robin's favorite. God. Boy with lonely eyes, my super favorite.
Aww.
But it's really, really sweet. Like the lyrics are really cute, and I love that Nanase Okawa wrote them. They feel like she wrote them.
Yeah, it from top to bottom, it just feels like such a, I mean, yeah, compression of their love or whatever. Like so much of their heart and soul is in this, and it's really nice.
It's a love letter to their fans, but it's also kind of a love letter to the world. Clamp's Wonderland. It's like, I love it. It's
Their world. Yeah, I love it.
Awesome. So thank you for coming with us on our journey through Clamp's Wonderland, very literally this time. You can follow us on Twitter at ClampCastPod, on Facebook as ClampCast in Wonderland. We also have a Facebook group there, and you can check out our website, ClampCastInWonderland.com. And you can check out our Patreon. No pressure, but again, we just want to build things for the future.
Yeah, and I believe you can join Patreon without pledging anything. So if you want to just subscribe to it now without, you know, picking a tier or anything, just so it's in your list, you can do that. And like, yeah, no pressure to you know, add it at any point in time. We're just trying to kind of get it out there while we can and while we're planning for the future.
Excellent.
All right. Until next time, remember that everything will be all right.
And try not to lose an eye.
Good night. I don't know why good night, but whatever.